I'm Christian Scheller. Welcome to my podcast, an enthusiastic ramble through whatever has taken my interest the past week or so. Expect technology, games, history, travel, geekery, and as always, much, much more. Welcome to Chinchilla Squeaks with me, Christian Scheller, recording this intro from a hotel room in Bilbao at the Open Source Summit organized by the Linux Foundation. Lots of interviews in progress that will be coming out of that over the coming episodes. But this episode, I just wanted to sneak in something from my backlog of interviews, because I've got quite a few, actually. So no links this time. I'm actually just going to get right into the interview and then come back with a little bit of an update from me at the end of it. This is my interview with Molham RF from Relational AI. Quite a technical but interesting project and startup. That any of you doing heavy AI and data work with Snowflake will find very interesting. Enjoy. How are you doing, Molham?
I'm doing all right, Chris. How are you?
Good. I always think running these late night calls, I'm far more awake than I am. And then I start talking and I realize I really am not. Especially when we have in your headline, the AI co-processor for your cloud data. That's a lot of complex terms I need to unpack at 11 p.m.
Well, I'd love to help you unpack them.
So tell me a little bit about relational AI and what an AI co-processor is.
Okay, I'd be happy to. So Relational AI is a Silicon Valley-based company. It's got about 200 people, a lot of engineers. We have about 150 engineers, 40 are field engineers, and 110 are product engineers. And we're working on sort of very new kind of database slash AI technology, right? So our work is at the intersection of databases and AI. And the way we define AI is to think of it sort of more holistically than just language models or even just deep learning or machine learning. We think of AI as also including graph technology, graph analytics, prescriptive analytics, things that involve optimizers and solvers for doing things like linear programming, integer programming, quadratic programming, rule-based reasoning engines to express different types of business logic and to allow you to model your business, simulation. In the 30 years I've been building intelligent applications in the enterprise, we've typically needed a combination of these things to develop these smart, high-value applications that people want. So that's what we mean by AI. By coprocessor, we mean something that plugs into your data cloud. We're very happy to have announced in July, our partnership with Snowflake. So Snowflake has created that category and is leading that category. And so if you're a Snowflake customer that wants to do graphs or rules or prescriptive analytics or certain types of predictive analytics, you typically have to move all your data out of Snowflake and use some technology that isn't, designed to work with Snowflake. Okay. And so that means you leave the security perimeter, you give up the governance infrastructure that you've worked hard to implement in Snowflake. That means typically that you're working with cloud hosted instead of cloud native solutions like Snowflake. So you don't get versioning, time travel, zero copy cloning. You don't get consumption pricing. You don't get effectively infinite storage and compute. So all that stuff you give up. And then finally, you have to typically use non-relational technology that's at the paradigm level incompatible with Snowflake, which is, you know, a relational technology at its foundation. And so we find that there's a lot of cost and friction and headaches and fragility that comes from having to do that we take off the table because we're embedded into Snowflake. We run inside of Snowflake as a part of a Snowpark container service. Mm-hmm. So we pick up all the governance. We're cloud native like Snowflake. So we have all of the features and consumption pricing, and we're relational like Snowflake. So you don't have any friction at the paradigm level. I hope that made some sense.
It does. Let's very quickly, for those who are not familiar, in very brief, because it's not really about them, what is Snowflake I think I've had a few related products and companies over the past couple of years talking about it, but let's just very quickly recap what it is.
Yeah, so for me, Snowflake is an amazing piece of technology because it's for the first time Snowflake figured out how to create a database that can not only hold all of the data for one enterprise, it can hold all the data for all enterprises. It's a supremely scalable database, relational database, SQL database, that was designed to handle big data. When people thought that there's no way to make a relational database support that workload, right? Remember 10 years ago, if you wanted to do big data, you had to go to Hadoop, and that was going to be the future of data management, right? Now, today, Hadoop is like COBOL. It's basically irrelevant. So Snowflake solved a major problem with OLAP databases, relational databases, in that it has this new kind of cloud-native architecture that makes it effectively infinitely scalable.
Yeah. Actually, that came up at a KubeCon talk. I was talking to
George,
someone who's more of a competitor to Snowflake than you. And they mentioned Hadoop. And it's like, I haven't heard anyone mention that in a long time. That it was so popular a few years ago. Yeah.
Just a few years ago. One of our major individual supporters sits on our board, major investor, is Bob Muglia, who was the CEO of Snowflake from 2014 to 2019. And he tells this funny story where 2 or 3 years before Snowflake had the largest and most successful software IPO of all time, he was turned down for funding 24 times, 25 times, something like that, because people thought that the future was Hadoop and systems like that. So really, you have to understand databases in a fundamental way to appreciate how a novel architecture can give you an advantage. And in our case, and that same architecture, but also combined with new kinds of join algorithms and semantic query technology and JIT compilation and incremental computation and relational language extensions that make it possible to support workloads that people didn't dream you could support in the relational paradigm.
Yeah, that's I think it's the relational part. It's also to get to this point, we came down the sort of NoSQL journey because that was the paradigm that people thought would be the only one that scaled.
Exactly, exactly.
And that wasn't that long ago either.
Yeah. I mean, there's a really interesting backstory to this, right? So the relational model is always laughed at for like a new interesting workload. It's laughed at as typically non-scalable, non-performant, and hard to understand, right? This was these debates happened in the 70s and early 80s around the OLTP workload, the transaction processing workload. Like, real engineers laughed at the relational model because real engineers use CodaSell database technology for transactions, you know. But we invented SQL and we invented B-trees and we invented Volcano-style query processing and rule-based optimizers. And by the time the mid-80s rolled around, it was like the only way to build transactional apps was with SQL and relational technology.
Yeah.
Same in the 90s for OLAP. I don't know if you remember OLAP and MOLAP and ROLAP. You know, again, for analytics, for analytical processing, people thought relational technology was going to be a joke. Yeah. Because if you want performance, you have to do it with arrays or what we call tensors today. And we invented parallel join algorithms and bitmap indices and column stores and vectorized query processing. And boom, no one talks about MOLAP anymore. It's only OLAP, because the only kind of OLAP you get is ROLAP. And then, of course, we just mentioned 10 years ago with big data workloads and Hadoop was going to be the future. And again, that wasn't the case. And so there are the nice thing about the model is separates the what from the how. The representation is independent from the implementation. And so you have flexibility in picking new architectures and picking new join algorithms and data structures that work really well for the new workload. And of course, if you can automate away all that programming and make things declarative, inevitably it will win, because who wants to do all the work to do this, the out-of-core memory management and the parallelization and the concurrency control and all that kind of stuff. Like, if we can avoid doing it at the application level, of course we would avoid doing it.
Yeah. Let's go back to relational AI. I was going to say relational because it just sounds a bit odd. But yeah. When you say co-processor, I think sort of two things come to mind, and I'd like to dig into a little bit about what exactly you're providing. So when I hear co-processor, I'm thinking something physical, but I'm assuming it probably isn't, or is it a combination of hardware and software?
Yeah, sorry. So we really thought hard about this because we knew that when we say coprocessor, most people's minds would go towards hardware. Okay. Yeah. But this is really an analogy, you know, I don't know how far back you go in computing, but in the early days, you know, you had the 8088 chip and it wasn't very good at floating point math. And so the 8087 was the coprocessor to make it do well. So that's obviously an example of a hardware coprocessor.
Yeah.
Of course, today we know all about GPUs. Yep. And so GPUs sit on the same motherboard as your CPU and they don't get used for most things. Like they don't get used for word processing or email or spreadsheeting. But when you need to do graphics or gaming or machine learning or crypto mining, they're essential. Okay. Mm. And the CPU knows how to offload the work onto the GPU. So by analogy, we're doing the same thing. Like relational systems like Snowflake are amazing at OLAP and certain types of transaction processing, and they can do JSON analytics and so on. But they themselves will tell you, if you need graphs, we're not your choice. If you want rules, that's not us. If you want prescriptive analytics, that's not us. So they leave you with this. Historically, you would have to leave that system. Okay, but now that they, Snowflake is working on becoming the data cloud, and so being a platform for all application development, they've created points of extensibility that let you plug us in as a relational engine that can do these things that it doesn't support. And so they win because now on their platform, you can do this stuff. Like Intel wins when, you know, on their platform, you can do graphics and gaming and machine learning. And of course, the customer wins because, you know, most of them have spent the last 2 or 3 years moving all their data onto Snowflake. And so the last thing they want to do is immediately move it off to build intelligence into their applications. And so it's wins for the customer, wins for Snowflake. Of course, it's a win for relational AI. And, you know, we want to be like the software equivalent of NVIDIA. For the software equivalent of Intel, or the database equivalent, I should say, for both. So.
Okay. And how did you get here? What made you or whoever else it was that founded the company want to do that? What gap, what pain point were you trying to
fill? Yeah, well, this goes back to the early 90s for me. So actually, this goes back when I was studying to be a computer scientist and a computer engineer. To be honest, my least favorite topic at the time when I was a student was databases. I mean, I thought, database is boring. But my real interest was machine learning and AI. And I started working in the early 90s on early versions of neural networks, okay? Solving problems like credit card fraud detection and supply chain forecasting and so on. And what you realize immediately when you start doing machine learning is getting the data right is super important. It's all about data and giving the machine learning algorithm examples of what happened in the past that it can generalize from. And so data management is fundamental to the learning part. It's also fundamental after you've created a model. Like let's say you created a model that detects credit card fraud. You want to deploy that model. And so you need a whole bunch of machinery like for workflow and so on, so that when the model scores a transaction as being, you know, a 95% likely to be fraud, what do you do with that? Do you stop the transaction always? Do you always let it go? Or maybe you say, well, for really important customers of mine, I'm going to let it go because I don't want to embarrass them at the restaurant. But for really like, you know, customers that don't matter to me and are not profitable, I'm going to be very conservative. I'm going to stop it right away and they'll have to prove that it's really them. And so you get into a whole bunch of other considerations, other decisions you have to make that might not be solved with a statistical machine learning model that might need a solver or might need some kind of rule workflow thing or might need, a simulation. These things are all work together to create the model and to deploy the model. So I had to learn data management. And then you quickly realize when you're doing data management, for AI, that there is no data management for AI. It's data management for OLTP or for OLAP or for big data, but not really for these other important workloads. So we basically, through several iterations, invented the technology that we're commercializing at Relational AI.
Can I just clarify what you mean by data management? Because I have interviewed a couple of companies that do what they also claim to be some form of management for ML and AI pipelines. But maybe you mean something slightly different when you say data management.
Yeah. Well, I mean like databases. I mean like in the Snowflake sense or their predecessors, right?
So I
mean
like database management stuff. Okay.
I mean, if we didn't have good databases that recorded everything, we wouldn't be able to do machine learning. Okay. And in most databases, we tend to have some kind of schema or model of the underlying business. And those databases have made it possible for us to collect the data so that we can do machine learning. Now, interestingly, the machine learning sort of world doesn't know anything about databases. You just expect all the data show up in a data frame or, like one big wide table. And they don't understand that in the enterprise, that data is not actually stored that way. It's stored in a normalized way in a database. Okay. Mm. So you spend a lot of time and energy creating a data model that allows you to get the data. And then the first thing that you do when you want to do machine learning is you spend a lot of time and energy flattening all that data out into a data frame so you can feed it to your favorite machine learning tool. And then that machine learning tool spends a lot of time and energy trying to reconstruct the knowledge, the background knowledge that it had, about the data, through sort of the domain model or the schema, right? So there's just these two worlds don't talk, and there's so much opportunity to streamline things and make things easier if you have technology that can sort of do walk and chew gum, that can sort of understand data management and database ideas with machine learning and AI ideas in general.
Okay. Now, what does the workflow for someone using relational AI look like? Sort of browsing your docs, I can see mentions of RKGS, RHEL. Talk me through the steps that someone wanting to use the service would actually go through to accomplish something from a Snowflake data source.
Yeah, so we've worked very hard with Snowflake to try to, again, minimize friction here for a user. So let's say you're using graph technology to build features to do a better job of detecting fraud or money laundering, or you want to have a customer 360 view, and so on. Or you're using graphs for supply chain management or whatever. Okay, so the historically what you'd have had to do is, again, through ETL or some other process, copy all the data out of Snowflake, put it, and then organize it in a way where you can load it into a graph database. And you would have had to manage the synchronization between those two things. And you would have had to learn a new query language for the graph database that isn't necessarily as familiar to you as SQL and some of the relational technologies. So with us, we think of a knowledge graph as really being a highly normalized relational database, something called graph normal form, okay, which is very similar to six normal form, which historically has been like interesting curiosity, but not practical to use. Okay. So we create, you give us, you plug us into Snowflake, and we create a relational knowledge graph as a set of materialized views on the data in Snowflake, on the tables in Snowflake. So, in the best case, right, let's say you just want, the capabilities we provide out of the box, you point us at your data, you create the mappings to the relational knowledge graph, very simple, very straightforward. And that relational knowledge graph is a set of materialized views on these tables, meaning if you add a record or remove a record from a table, it's automatically mapped and synchronized with the graph. And a library of graph routines are available to you via SQL or via Python in Snowflake. And then you just, use SQL to evaluate page rank or between the centrality or, path counting or whatever it is that you want. And your data, from your perspective, your data is in SQL tables. You run us like you would run a stored procedure or a UDF, and then you see the results back in a SQL table. So you haven't had to learn a special query language or worry about synchronizing the data or anything like that, okay? Now, at some point, you might want more than what we built in terms of our basic graph libraries or our graph library. And so if you want to do more than that, then we make available to you a stored relational language, not a stored procedural language, that lets you write rules, you know, A equals B plus C if you want, or, I want, all paths of length five, you know, by joining together an edge relation, you know, five times. And you can sort of build on top of the built-in capabilities, okay? But you can get a lot of value without having to know anything other than SQL.
And this is the RHEL.
Yes, and RHEL is the stored relational language that you would use. And that's what's on our website, because if you need access to that information, you have to come to our website. Okay. Perhaps it sends the wrong message. Perhaps it sends a message that you have to learn that to be able to do useful work. But we'll update our website.
It's hard to say. I mean, would most people, do you think most people would discover you through you or through Snowflake, and then that probably is the onboarding from where most of your customers are coming from, I guess?
I think from Snowflake. Like, we went to Summit, we made that announcement, we were highlighted in the keynote at the very end. They showed like a 15-second live demo of our system, and it was amazing, the response. Mm-hmm. So many people who are looking at graphs that have been thinking about it as, oh man, in order to do this, I have to use a non-embedded, non-cloud native, non-relational solution that I can't pay for on a consumption basis. I have to pre-allocate hardware. I have to do all this stuff. And all of a sudden, we're just saying, hey, it's just a stored relational, it's just a SQL call or a stored relational query inside your system. Mm. I mean, we left that conference with, over 100 leads. And we've already started POCs with several of them. And the general reaction is, I love it. It sounds too good to be true. And I love to hear it sounds too good to be true, because I know it's true. And so if we can demonstrate that, then we're all set. So,
yeah. But just one question. Do you have any concerns about having, your business being based off the back of someone else's? Do you have any plans to integrate with other, at least vaguely comparable platforms, or exist in isolation somehow, or some way of having a backup plan just in case?
Fair question. I get that from a variety of folks, our investors and our colleagues. Did NVIDIA have any concerns about driving most of its business from Intel-based hardware? I in the end, that was certainly a very smart move. And at different points in time, Intel was worth more than NVIDIA, and NVIDIA worth more than Intel. I think they've demonstrated how the coprocessor model can be very, very effective for both the processor and the coprocessor. Like, Intel might not be as dominant if it didn't have the 8087 initially and it didn't have GPUs at some point. So the flip side of that is NVIDIA does work with ARM and AMD and so on. And so whereas I expect Snowflake to be the dominant provider, the category leader in the data cloud world, I do expect there will be a number two and a number three and a number four. And there's nothing architecturally or from a business model perspective that stops us from working with the AMDs of the world and the ARMs of the world, if you know what I mean, right?
Just in case Snowflake becomes the next Hadoop.
I don't think that's likely to happen anytime soon.
No, for sure.
Even if they don't, like, Intel is still the leader in CPUs. It's just people get used to having a coprocessor. And if you have a unique data management technology, you might still want us as a coprocessor to that.
Yeah. Okay. And I get the impression from the announcements that the company, at least publicly, is fairly new, I think.
We're about 5 years old. So the research that was done on the algorithms, the underlying technology, goes back over 10 years and spans about 20 different universities. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just because you have the main announcement about introducing the industry's first AI coprocessor. That was relatively recent.
Yes.
So before that, were you fitting in a different way, or that was just kind of more of a consolidation of coming out into the wild, I guess?
Well, so we have a handful of very large clients that have been using us. We've been in production for 2 or 3 years, working in partnership with, they were quoted in our press release, AT&T and other large companies. So that's been very good for us. When we started working with them, we were kind of independent of any data management technology because we were just trying to validate that the technology works and scales and all of that. Okay. However, as you probably know, AT&T is a huge Snowflake customer. So they're very, very excited about us being a coprocessor there because we take out, a whole bunch of integration headaches. So we focused on the engineering first and making sure that the product scales and performs and is as usable as it should be. And then we started experimenting with different go-to-market motions. And this sort of partner-led motion with Snowflake as our first and most important partner is very, very proven to be very effective. And so that was sort of the second half of building our company is deciding on the go-to-market motion. Okay.
So my main reason for asking that, just to clarify, was so that's kind of the most recent announcements. What's next? Next 6 months, 12 months, what's on the roadmap?
Next 6 months, we are going to be laser focused on Snowflake. We're going to make sure that I said we left the conference with 100 plus leads. Snowflake has 8,100 customers. I bet you the great majority of them want graphs and rules and predictive and prescriptive analytics. And so there is so much to do to make sure those clients and those prospects are delighted with the pairing. So I don't anticipate any major announcements in the next 6 to 12 months other than announcements of customers being happy with our combined solution.
Yeah. It's also interesting to hear 8,100 is high, but not crazy high. So there's also a lot more potential in the future as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so this is as of the last quarterly earnings report for Snowflake, but they keep adding, right? Mm. So if we talk again in a few months, I'm sure it will be substantially higher than 8,100 and it keeps growing. So we're chasing their growth in a sense. So.
Okay. And just out of pure interest, I notice you do have something of a GitHub presence. So how much of what you have is open versus proprietary? Is it just SDKs and things like that?
So the SDKs are definitely open. Yeah. Some of the components that we build, like the basic building blocks, are put out in the open source community.
Oh, yeah, the engine,
Yeah, we're going to also open source the language. So RHEL, we're working on defining semantics for it and providing a reference implementation for people who want to use it as a stored relational engine stored relational language, I should say, in other contexts. Again, a lot of our work is done in collaboration with some of the best universities on the planet, and we work with the professors and the PhD students, and it's important for publishing that we do work in the open. And so we have dozens of papers that describe various aspects of the system also out there as well. So,
and if anyone's interested in what we've been talking about, is relational AI kind of a self-serve? Can people test it, or is it still very much at that stage of they have to come and talk to you and do POCs?
Not yet. We announced private preview at Summit a month ago. And so that means between us and Snowflake, we have some work to do to get to public preview. When we get to public preview late this year or early next year, it will be much more self-serve. But if you're curious and you want to know, please email me or please just, they're on our website. There are places you can just email and register your interest. And we'd love to get user feedback early and often. So,
and that was my interview with Molham Arif. So a couple of things from me that I've released over the past week, because it has only been a week between episodes. I added a video, a hands-on video about how I digitized some PDF sheet music using a couple of tools, which was at least interesting and useful to me, even if nobody else. That's over on YouTube. And also there is now video versions. I can't even remember if I've actually mentioned these before or not, but other videos are quickly configuring macOS displays with DisplayPlacer, quite a cool little open source tool. And my video of the future of documentation being dynamic. On that, there's also now a blog post version of that that post, which is over on Medium. Link in the show notes. And I think that's it. I have a blog version of the DisplayPlacer video very nearly done, but I'll probably release that next week, to be honest with you. And as mentioned last week as well, I have a collection of Flash Fiction out. If you go to Drive Through Fiction or Amazon, you can find print and EPUB versions, and also on Drive Through, an ebook version of a small gregarious fiction, Volume 1. That is it. And my overhauled website with new branding and things is very nearly there. I'm having to migrate a lot of the images, which is a bit time consuming. But it's getting there. I may soft release some of that quite soon. There's also no dark mode. I'm sorry. That will come soon as well. I'm also going to be overhauling the podcast pages very soon with at least transcripts and summaries of each episode. I'm just trying to figure out the best combination of SaaS or local tools to do that for me. And then maybe coming soon after that will be some kind of interactive player, so you can actually jump between the transcripts on the episode. And equally, I am about to also overhaul all my YouTube thumbnails, but again, figuring out the best options, and they will all be blogged about, of course, when I have finally figured it out. All of that can be found on the aforementioned website that is undergoing all of this overhaul. That is chrischinchilla.com, where you can also find ways to support me if you enjoy what I do. But until next time, which will probably be next week as well, with another interview from the backlog, I have been Chris Chinchilla. Thank you very much for joining me, and take care, everybody.
I hope you enjoyed the show. Find out more about me at chrischinchilla.com, where you can find show notes, sign up for my newsletter, and find all of my writing, games, work, and video links. There's also details on how to get in touch with me. And if you want to get even closer to what I do, join my Discord server for behind-the-scenes discussions and helping me produce my shows and work.